Slater, lyricist of School of Rock and Gallivant. I'm talking to Dave Lefkowitz of Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Here on the 12th annual Dave's Gone By Total Theater Tony Award special on UNC Radio. Very happy to talk to a Tony nominee. Now, he is already a Grammy Award winner, and he's already gotten another Tony nomination. That was for Sister Act a couple of years ago. But now, Glenn Slater is back in a big way with the soon-to-be-hit Broadway musical School of Rock, co-written with someone you might have heard of, Lloyd Webber or something. We'll get into that. But anyway, Glenn Slater is a Claiborne Award winner, also a Jonathan Larson Award winner, for his work in lyrics. You can watch them on TV on Gallivant and, of course, see them on Broadway in School of Rock. Welcome, Glenn Slater, to the Daverhood.
Hi, Dave.
Well, hi. How you feeling about your second Tony nod?
Pretty good. This is actually my third Tony nod. I got a Tony nod for The Little Mermaid 5 or 6 years ago as well. So this is my third time up at bat.
Oh, congratulations on that. I did not remember about The Little Mermaid 2. Let's roll backwards to like the first time you started writing for Broadway. Was that Mermaid or Class Act, or which one was that?
Well, Class Act was the first time any of my words were heard on Broadway, but that was literally, I think, maybe 2 or 3 lines of lyrics. A Class Act, for anybody who doesn't remember, was a musical that was based around the works of Ed Kleban, who wrote a chorus line. It's this big, famous thing. You know, he's one of those writers who is sort of legendary in the business, but most of whose work never got produced, so a lot of that material was new to people.
A Class Act is one of my very favorite musicals of the past 20, 25 years. I just loved it.
Yeah, beautifully put together. And Lonnie Price, who was putting it together, was looking to make some of the songs fit the narrative a little bit better than they were. And we worked for a little bit of time adjusting some of his lyrics until both of us realized this whole show is about a guy who is so uncompromising about his work that he wouldn't change anything in order to get it on stage. How could we possibly change his lyrics for this? It made no sense. It was sort of counter to the whole idea of the show in the first place.
Now, until
we put most of everything back and just left that 1 or 2 lines.
And you probably felt at that point somewhat confident because you had the experience of being in the same workshop that Claiborne was part of in the early years, that BMI workshop. What did you learn doing that?
Well, the BMI workshop is sort of a legendary part of the Broadway experience for writers. It was founded by Lehman Engel, gosh, back in the 60s, I think. And so many fantastic writers and writers who are sort of at the top of the mountain today are directly from that workshop. Alan Menken went through it, Maury Estern, Aaron Zamplarity. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's basically a place where you go. It's a free course, and they teach you the fundamentals of how to put together a show, how to think about which songs fit which roles, how to sort of plot out just the basic emotional beats of a show. They also pair you with a different collaborator every few weeks. So as a lyricist, you get to work with 10 different composers in the course of the year. So you get a lot of experience in just working with other people, figuring out what your style is, what kind of a style you work best with. It's a real introduction to the world of musical theater writing and something that gives you a real leg up in the industry.
It's like musical theater boot camp. So have any of
exactly.
The people that you were paired with when you were at BMI, have you worked with them professionally since?
Just one writer, a man named Steve Wiener, who I collaborated with for quite a long time. We had one show together at Manhattan Theater Club called New Yorkers, and we had a couple of tough breaks with shows that we ultimately ran into rights issues with, one of which is an adaptation of the Coen Brothers' The Hudsucker Proxy, maybe one of the best things I've ever written. And unfortunately, we were in a little bit of a situation where we can't get the show up because of the rights. But, you know, fingers crossed, maybe one day.
Now, that's weird, because at least one of the Coens is a playwright, and he's always doing theater stuff. You figure he'd be amenable to...
You know, I mean, I'm not going to speculate on reasons. I think that there's a lot of goodwill on both sides and just a lot of things to get through, and I'm sure we will at some point. I'm not concerned. I think it will have its day at some point.
Now, moving back to that second show, you had done a little bit of touch-up, as you said, on a Class Act, and then came Ba-Boom, The Little Mermaid.
Right.
What was that? I mean, working with Howard Ashman, or post-Howard Ashman, we did for the animated film, but of course he was no longer around. So how did that, A, come about, and how was it working with Disney on that?
Well, I had been working with Alan for 8 or 9 years by the time Little Mermaid opened. We had worked on that show for much of that time. We had come together on a different project, which was a sequel to the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Hmm. It was actually meant to be a prequel, the story of how Roger got to Hollywood in the first place. And rather than be a parody of film noir, the way the first one was, this was more a parody of the old MGM musicals.
Oh.
Alan had been working with a different lyricist, and I had been doing a separate project with Disney. And when that lyricist fell off the project, Disney said to Alan, "Hey, we've got this guy we've been working with whose style is very similar to Howard Ashman's. Would you take a meeting?" And so we met, and we just had a sort of an instant click. Alan and I both have very similar taste in music and very similar taste in pop music and a breadth of knowledge about pop music, and we just immediately understood each other. We wrote probably 5 or 6 songs for that project before that ended up not getting the green light. And then we moved on to a movie that was eventually called Home on the Range, which was a Western animated film. Hmm. And while we were still working on that, they came to Alan and said, "We're going to go forward with Little Mermaid for Broadway. We're going to need 10 or 12 more songs to augment the 5 or 6 of the film." And Alan asked if I would step into Howard's shoes and take up the slack.
Now, when you're asked to do a project like that, do you go in sort of knowing that no matter how good the songs you add are, how polished the lyrics are, how melodic they are, everybody's going to say, "Well, it's not as good as the movie." How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, Howard Ashman's shoes are very big shoes to fill. Yeah, he's sort of an acknowledged genius, and I have to say that watching the Little Mermaid film when I was in college is sort of how I learned how to write ballads and figured out, oh, this is how you write musical theater in a pop context.
Mm.
And so I had a huge amount of respect going in and a huge amount of trepidation. When the songs from the film have been around for 20 years and they're acknowledged classics and people know every word and every note of music, you sort of know going in that no matter what you write, it's never going to have that same emotional effect on people. We also ran into a slight problem in that Howard made such a brilliant... Howard's placement of where the songs go, Howard's sense of where to put those songs in order to make them work for a 90-minute animated film was sort of fresh and novel and impeccable. But he specifically did it to work for an animated film and not for a two-act musical. And so it was very hard to fill in songs for the characters, knowing that you'd have to have Ariel sing more than one song, you'd have to have Ursula sing more than one song. Mm-hmm. Where to place those songs and what to have them say when the original songs were placed perfectly and said everything that needed to be said. So a lot of thought went into how to expand that world without stepping on what he had already done so well.
Well, now your current show, School of Rock, which I would call it a hit, but it's not technically a hit until it makes back its last penny, but it's selling very, very well, and people are digging it. And I saw it, and I liked it very, very much. So this one, at least, you could work from source material where there was music in it, but at least you could create all new music with this guy, this Andrew Lloyd Webber guy. How did you get hooked up with Andrew Lloyd Webber?
This is actually the second show I've done with Lord Webber.
No, you won't. Please tell me you won't call him Lord.
No, we call him Andrew.
Okay.
Previously, he had called me to do a sequel to Phantom of the Opera with him called Love Never Dies.
All right,
yeah. Which opened in London a few years ago, and I believe is coming on a U.S. tour next year. You know, that show is very much in his wheelhouse. It's a big, operatic, big, lush, huge numbers, really beautiful. But I'm more of a comic writer and more of a contemporary writer, and so it was exciting for me to sort of spread my wings and stretch on that one. While we were working on it, he had mentioned being interested in School of Rock as a property because Andrew has always been very involved in music education in the schools, teaching music to kids, very convinced of the importance that kids learn music at a young age. And obviously that's part of the theme of School of Rock as well.
Yeah.
I happen to have a son who's in a School of Rock here in New York and has been for several years and who loves it. And so I knew that world and knew what those kids were like very well. And so I kept hitting him, when you're ready, I'm ready at any time. And he finally called me and said, "Let's do this."
Mm.
When he first gave me the call, his original thought was that he would just produce it and that we would use existing pop songs.
Yeah, that when news came out about School of Rock being done, it was the thing was that it was just going to include a lot of 80s, like 90s pop rock metal hits. Mm. And then it was a surprise when...
Yeah. Well, you know, we had our first meeting. Andrew and Julian Fellows, who wrote the book, and Lawrence Connor, the director, and myself. And we all sat down, and Lawrence Connor is a big heavy metal fan, and I'm a huge rock and pop historian. I've listened to everything from every era. We sat down and began talking about it, and it became obvious very quickly that the style that Dewey Finn, our lead character, would think about music and the kind of rock music he likes is that kind of big, operatic, bombastic rock. You think of Queen, you think of Jim Steinman and Meatloaf, things that are almost orchestral in their size and their scope and their ambition. And we said, Andrew, this should be something that you can do. And after all, you are the father of the rock musical with Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph and the Amazing and Technicolor Dreamcoat. You pioneered this, and this is a sound that you can do. He's like, well, I'm not sure. And so we sat him down, and through Spotify, I think we played an AC/DC song for him that has very intricate guitar work. He looked up and he said, well, that sounds a little bit like Paganini. We said, yes, Andrew, it does, doesn't it? Well, I could do that. And he said, come, let's listen to some music. And he led us through his estate, Sitmonton, which is this big, enormous country house that he lives in, filled with Victorian art. And we went all through the hallways, past these huge pictures and statues, to a little closet in the side room. And he opened up that closet, and it was ceiling to floor vinyl records. Hundreds, thousands, God knows how many were in there. And he literally had every AC/DC record, every Genesis record. You name it, it was in there. And he said, well, let's start with the A's. And we started with AC/DC and just spent several hours listening through. The four of us rocking out. And if you can imagine Julian Fellows rocking out, it's a fairly amusing image.
Okay. When you got to the process of physically working on the songs, did you have any great aha moments? Like, well, we need a song for this character. You're hitting a wall, and then, one of you came up with the aha moment.
Well, you know, unlike the way he's worked in the past, I mean, my understanding is that when he worked with Tim Rice, Tim would do lyrics first, and he would sort of fill in behind, and then they'd work together after that. And then there was a long stretch where Andrew did music first. When we worked together on Love Never Dies, by the time I came on the project, he had already written about an hour and a half worth of music. A lot of music had been written. And so I had to come in and sort of fill in the story into notes that were already there. Right. On this one, he came without any ideas. When we finally convinced him, you can do this, we sat down together and he said, okay, what are you thinking? What kind of sound do you have in mind? What kind of thoughts do you have in mind? Which was fantastic for me because that enabled me to take the lead a little bit. The first week together, I sort of gave him sketches for lyrics for the tentpole songs in the show. One called When I Climbed to the Top of Mount Rock, which is Dewey's sort of I Want song. I had in mind I specifically said, this is our Meatloaf moment. This is our Bat Out of Hell. This is our big, huge, operatic, over-the-top, peons, everything rock. And I gave him a verse and a bit of a chorus. And he looked at me and he said, okay, I know what to do with this. And he went off by himself and came back about half an hour later and said, here's what I'm thinking. And it was like, yes, that is it. You have nailed it. We are on our way. And in short order, in that first week, we put together sketches like that for Stick It to the Man, which is the big anthemic song.
Yeah.
You're in the Band, which is the song in which he sort of puts together, he sort of figures out which kids can play which instruments and forms them into a band. And If Only You Could Listen, which is the plea that the kids make to their parents. As a musical theater writer, if you can put together four songs in a week, you know that you've hit the beat. You know that you're on the right track. And so we just roared forward from there. I'm Glenn Slater, lyricist of School of Rock and Gallivant. I'm talking to Dave Lefkowitz of Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Here's something my a colleague and friend of mine said, that the one thing we all know about theater and Broadway is that nobody knows anything. You know, if producers could predict what would be a hit, what would be a... And you think you know, and you can always see 20/20 hindsight of, well, that wasn't a hit because... Or, of course, that was a big hit because... But it's always through hindsight. You never know beforehand. So it's looking like School of Rock will be a hit. And congratulations on that. And deservedly, because it's a really, really fun show. But when you were working on some other recent shows, like Leap of Faith, did it take until the reviews came out the day after that you, not going to happen? Do you think up until that very moment the curtain goes up on opening night that, oh, we got a hit? Or do you have something in your gut that tells you maybe, maybe not?
Well, Leap of Faith was a complicated problem. I was not the first lyricist on it. I came on a little bit of a ways in. A decision had already been made by the time I came on board, which was that Jonas, who's the lead character in the film version of the story, he does not connect with the love interest and ends off going off alone. The decision was made before I came on board that we would have a proper love story and that he would fall in love with the waitress. And once that decision was made, a lot of story issues became a little bit set. You needed to redeem him. You needed to make him marriageable. You needed to make him likable. A series of decisions to make that happen meant that the character got a little bit off base, I think. And we spent a lot of time, I mean, years, trying to get the story to work with that dynamic in place. And there were times when we came closer to getting it to work and times when we were further away from getting it to work. It sort of went in cycles, depending on which workshop we were in or which production we were in. You know, we never quite solved it. And I think we ended up rushing to Broadway a little sooner than we were ready for and opened at a time when we still were in a downward progression with it rather than an upward progression with it. We just didn't have enough preview time, I think, really, to solve the problems that needed to be solved. Just speaking for Alan and myself, I don't think we were surprised at where it ended up or how it ended up, but just disappointed that we opened when we did before we came up with a solution. And honestly, with hindsight, I think that the problem was that very first decision to make him the love interest. Sort of, if I could go back and fix something, I would be going back and saying, that's where our mistake is. Let's go back and change that.
Well, I just love the honesty, you know, the pragmatic honesty with which you approach something like that. Because I do remember when Leap of Faith was promised year after year for Broadwaying, it would do this at workshop and then it was this side of town, and then it was almost sudden, I guess, a theater opened up and you had to grab it while it was there. But as you're saying, it was just not the right time and not the right draft of the script. But also, let's take Sister Act, which was, I don't know if that was technically a hit or may have come close, certainly was received better.
I think it was a critical hit. Critics really, really enjoyed it. The audiences really enjoyed it. I'm not sure if it ended up being a financial hit on Broadway, but since then it has played all over the world and continues to tour, and I think it qualifies as a worldwide hit at this point because it's been done so many places for so long. I mean, it's been running continuously in professional productions ever since we opened. I count it as a hit.
Yeah, the reason I even mentioned that is I've been reading Jack Vertel's book. Have you read that about the musical?
I haven't, actually.
It's fabulous. And it goes to all the things we were talking about BMI. But in one place, he describes The Wedding Singer as a failed musical, even though he liked parts of it. And it's like, well, he explains why, in a structural way, The Wedding Singer has a big, big problem. But to call it a failed musical because it flopped kind of on Broadway, and yet it's had tons and tons of productions, and people love it. So that word kind of stuck in my craw a little bit. And I sort of feel that's maybe a sort of a sister act situation, where on Broadway it was one thing, but in 400 other places, something else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Sister Act had the misfortune of opening just a few weeks after Book of Mormon, which was also religious-themed and irreverent, and obviously a juggernaut. I think we just sort of got lost in the mix a little bit. But certainly the people who did see it mostly loved it, and I think out of the context of that particular Broadway season, when people see the show, they realize that, oh, this is a hit that could have been and should have been, and in most respects is.
Well, speaking about having the wrong time and potentially getting lost, we can't ignore the elephant in the room this year in musicals on Broadway. You're up against a show, and it's not Allegiance, you know, it's not Amazing Grace, it's Hamilton. So, happily, your show, at the box office at least, is doing just fine. But you kind of wish, if we open next year, not this one, we'd probably do a little better in the Tonys, etc.?
Well, I have to be honest. I'm really excited about the Tonys, and I'm really proud that our show got the 4 nominations.
Yeah.
But that's sort of not the most important thing to me. I wouldn't put off a show that's ready to open in order to win awards. That doesn't make sense to me. When a show's ready, it's ready.
Mm.
And we had a perfect cast assembled and a perfect creative team assembled, and it was ready to go. Yes, I mean, part of me wishes that we were in a season where all the attention wasn't on Hamilton, but I will say that Hamilton is bringing a lot of attention to Broadway. It's bringing the attention of a lot of young people to Broadway.
Mm.
It's opening up the bounds of what Broadway music can be in a way that I think benefits us, because we're also opening up those bounds in certain ways. Just having Broadway become a cultural force again, which it hasn't been for many, many years, but certainly Hamilton has opened up Broadway to a much, much wider spotlight than it's had in a long time, and I think that helps every show, and I think it helps us as well. So I'm actually kind of happy to be in this season. And God knows, if you have to be behind something, like, that's sort of, it's a great thing to be behind. There's no shame in taking second place to that.
And also, if you've got X umpteen million people tuning in tomorrow night to watch the Tonys,
Exactly. Well,
they're going to see their School of Rock performance too. So
exactly. They're going to see that School of Rock is just as energetic and fun and exciting and fresh and of the moment. And that's what that audience is looking for. So it all works.
Now, a couple more quick questions for Glenn Slater. And again, we're very thrilled that you took the time to talk to us on our Tony Award special. But I have two questions about two of the other things that you have done in your career. One of them is still on ABC TV. Gallivant is still running?
We actually just got canceled.
Yeah, I know.
So
yeah.
At the moment, we're not running, but there's a huge fan campaign in progress to bring us to a new network and to continue the story, which, fingers crossed, will have the desired effect.
Yeah, I read one person reviewing and said, he didn't really want to tune in. And then as soon as he saw the first episode, he binge-watched the other five of the first season. He couldn't get enough of it because he wanted to see what was happening, and it was fun and funny. So I do hope it continues that way. And the other question is, and there's a twinge of jealousy here involved, because when I was applying for schools way, way back when I was in high school, I applied to three schools, and they were Harvard, Yale, and my safe school was NYU. Well, I got into my safe school, but I never got into Harvard. You did, and you were part of the whole hasty pudding thing. And I've got to ask,
yes.
What was that like?
A fantastic experience. You know, the hasty pudding, for anybody who doesn't know, is an all-male theatrical show that Harvard puts on every year and has since the early 1800s, if not earlier. It's usually a show that parodies existing shows and is set in some period of history that's sort of a fun place to romp. And I think the closest thing I could compare it to would be something like the Airplane movies, but with songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of really broad, crazy, joke-a-minute, pun-filled laugh fest. And it's done at an extremely high level. A lot of the performers in it go on to professional careers. The costumes are always brilliant, the sets are always brilliant, and the creative team that you work with, the lighting designer and the music director and the director and the choreographer, are always Broadway level top notch. So it's an amazing institution to be a part of. One of the great experiences you can have as a college kid is writing a show and seeing it done at that level.
Oh, absolutely. Well, can you give me like one lyric or memory or moment of your hasty pudding work when it was on stage and went, "That's mine! I wrote that, yay, and it worked."
You know, I can't quote the lyrics back. And actually, back when I did the Hasty Pudding Show, I wasn't a lyricist, believe it or not.
Oh, oh.
Back then, I wrote the music. I was a composer. I started out as a composer.
Oh,
I just wrote the music. I didn't write any lyrics for it. It wasn't until I came to New York with the intention of being a composer, and I met actual composers, and I realized, uh-oh, I just don't have the skill level to compete with these guys. If I actually want a career in the theater, I need to rethink what I'm doing. I switched to doing lyrics and never looked back. But all through college, I was a straight-up composer, never wrote a word of lyric.
Oh, wow. Well, speaking of never looking back, looking forward, because as we all know, everyone has to have a dozen irons in the fire in the hopes that one will heat up and take off. What are the projects that you are, you mentioned one before, but what are some of the other projects that you are currently working on?
Alan Menken and I have A Bronx Tale opening on Broadway probably this season.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I, which we had previously done at the Paper Mill Playhouse, our out-of-town run, which went extremely well, very successful.
And the reviews were great.
The reviews were great. The book is by Chaz Palminteri, and it's sort of a story from his actual life, which is sort of an amazing resource to have Chaz Palminteri there telling you when you're telling the story right or wrong. And it's co-directed by Jerry Zaks and Robert De Niro. So it's a pretty high-powered team. We're really excited about it.
Do you think it could come this season, or do you think 2017-18?
I think they're hoping and working towards it being during this 16-17 upcoming season.
Wow, okay, cool. And what else?
After that, I'm doing a show with my wife, whose name is Wendy Lee Wilson, called Beatsville, which is a beatnik jazz bebop musical, for which she wrote the music and lyrics. I'm just doing the book on that one. And we're taking that out of town to the Oslo Rep in Sarasota.
Oh, nice.
Spring of 2017, and then it goes to the Fifth Avenue in Seattle in the fall of 2017. And if all goes well, then hopefully coming back home to New York after that.
Now Wikipedia says that's based on a Roger Corman movie called, like, Buckets of Blood or something. Do you think that'll go over in Florida?
Well, you know, it's certainly based on a horror movie, but I think we have a really fun spin on it. It's set in a world that is so much fun to be in, the world of beatniks with the goatees and the bongos and the berets. And the style of music, which is sort of bebop, vocalese, jazz, I think is the kind of music that's going to have a very wide appeal because on the one hand, it's certainly related to music that if you were alive back in the 50s, this is what you knew. But if you're a teenager or somebody in your 20s, basically bebop vocalese was the hip-hop of that era. Lots of words, lots of internal rhymes, lots of ideas. And my wife, who wrote the lyrics, had so much fun with it. She did just really hilarious work. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, it has been a lot of fun hearing your words and ideas, Glenn Slater. Everybody, please, please go to see School of Rock at the Winter Garden Theater on Broadway. Also, the cast recording is out, so you got to get yourself that. And make sure you Netflix, you binge watch, get it on DVD when it comes out, Gallivant, and hope that it finds another home on TV as well. Glenn Slater, good luck tomorrow night at the Tonys. Fingers crossed. And thank you. Thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Dave.